Good afternoon, everybody, and thank you again for joining our now this is our second call this month of the BDS Monitor conference calls. This afternoon, we have the opportunity to hear from two friends and colleagues of SPME, Tammy Benjamin and Leela Beckwith, both the co-founders of the Amchel Initiative, as well as current and past board members of SPME, who have been diligently fighting a lot of the same issues that we deal with regarding anti-Semitism all around, as well as problems that we deal with in academia. Of late, AMCHA has released a new study on faculty issues and the correlations that generated between faculty opinions as it relates to BDS and how it correlates to anti-Semitism on campus, and how the connection between those faculty members who support BDS is definitely a clear indicator of their support for activism on campus that is that part of the challenges that we face. So that will be their topic this afternoon, and I will let them talk about that. A few housekeeping issues before we start the call. For those of you who are on the call now and have been with us in the past, so you're aware. You can see, for those of you who are logged in on a computer, you will be able to see a hand icon. Should you have a question after, and we encourage questions, after Tammy and Leela are done speaking, please press on the icon and I will be able to unmute you and you'll be able to ask your question. You're also able to ask questions by texting during the call through the system. As always, our email is bdsmonitor@spme.org. You can always ask questions if you have questions after the call. And again, that email is bdsmonitor@spme.org. And again, if you have questions, which you know you are encouraged to ask, please ask them after Tammy and Leela are done. So without further ado, the floor is yours. Tammy, Leela, please.
Thanks. Thanks, Asaf, and good morning or afternoon, depending on where you are. We're in the, Leela and I are both in not so sunny California, and it's about 9 o'clock here. So hello to everybody. Leela and I agreed that I would be the spokesperson today, at least to tell you about our research, but Leela and I did this research together, and she's going to be jumping in when she feels the need, and also either during this presentation or after. So one consistent and curious finding of each of our organization's previous three studies on anti-Semitic activity on U.S. campuses was that the presence of faculty on a given campus who have publicly endorsed an academic boycott of Israeli universities and scholars is one of the best predictors of acts of anti-Jewish hostility, including assault, harassment, destruction of property, and suppression of speech. Now, this is curious because, of course, the faculty aren't beating up students in the campus square. We do have lots of instances of peer-on-peer harassment, but very few instances of faculty harassment of students. So the fact that that this would be the case was curious to us. And what we found was that schools with one or more faculty boycotters are about 5 to 6 times more likely to play host to acts of aggression against Jewish students. And the more faculty boycotters, the greater the likelihood of such anti-Semitic acts. The correlations were very, very high. So in an attempt to unpack this finding and to understand how faculty boycotters might actually contribute to campus anti-Semitism, Leela and I decided to do a big empirical study that focused specifically on the 965 academic boycotters at the 113 schools with the largest Jewish undergraduate population. So these were the same schools that our three previous studies on anti-Semitic activity had focused on. So I wanted to use the same essential data set when it came to the schools and the academic boycotters that we had previously measured their relationship to acts of anti-Jewish aggression. We wanted to use the same data set. And we wanted to answer a series of questions about the academic boycotters, including and especially to what extent they bring their support for BDS onto campus and what harm it might do. So the first question we asked of our data was, who are the academic boycotters? I mean, what schools are they concentrated in what disciplines is their scholarship, and with what departments and programs are they affiliated? So here are some, I guess, some fun facts. 86% of the schools in our study had one or more academic boycotters on faculty, and the top five schools with the most boycotters were NYU with 45 academic boycotters, UC Berkeley with 40, Vassar with 38, and Columbia and UC Davis, which tied with 36 academic boycotters each. We also found that 93% of the academic boycotters had a primary affiliation in departments or programs in the humanities and or social sciences. Interestingly, the top two disciplines of primary affiliation for the boycotters were English and literature, which accounted for a little over 22% of the boycotters, and anthropology, which also accounted for about 22% of the boycotters. So together, these two disciplines, English, literature, anthropology, they accounted for almost half of all the boycotters, which was at first a curious kind of statistic until we realized that between two-thirds and three-quarters of the faculty boycotters in English and anthropology had a secondary affiliation or appointment in either ethnic studies, gender studies, or Middle East studies departments, and that it's really these three areas of study, ethnic, gender, and Middle East studies, that seem to be magnets for academic boycotters. In fact, more than 70% of academic boycotters had a primary or secondary affiliation in ethnic, gender, or Middle East studies. And I'm going to come back to this point in just a minute or two. We also found that some university departments are actually dominated by BDS supporters. So I bring a few examples from Leela and my university system, the University of California, where 83% of the tenured faculty in the UC Santa Cruz Feminist Studies Department are academic boycotters. 71% of the UC Davis Asian American Studies Program are boycotters, and 70% of the UCLA Gender Studies Program are academic boycotters. So those are some fun facts about the academic boycotters and their demographics on campuses across the country. So the next question, the second question really that our study addressed was, are academic boycotters actually bringing BDS, and in particular, an academic boycott of Israel, onto their campuses? You know, it's one thing to sign a petition or advocate for an academic boycott of Israel on one's own time and dime, but it's another thing to advocate for the boycott in one's classroom or conference hall, and it's still another thing to actually implement the academic boycott's guidelines on one's campus by actively seeking to shut down travel, study, or research in Israel or with Israeli scholars. So going into our study, we actually had quite a bit of what we think of as anecdotal evidence that academic boycotters are advocating for BDS on the job, in their classrooms, at departmentally sponsored events, as part of their research, and on university websites. I mean, we had lots of examples that, you know, from that had been reported or were in the news about faculty who were advocating for BDS or an academic boycott as part of their university jobs. Although it's rarer and harder to find, we were also aware that some faculty boycotters were actually going beyond merely advocating for an academic boycott of Israel to actually implementing an academic boycott or the guidelines, the PACB guidelines, or the guidelines of the Palestinian campaign for the academic and cultural boycott of Israel, which are very specific. And these guidelines call for essentially shutting down research, education, events that have to do with Israel or in Israel, or collaboration with Israeli scholars. And we did have a few examples, although, as I said, they're much harder to find since they happen by and large behind closed doors and they're not publicly accessible to us in the same way that, let's say, public events that are departmentally sponsored are. So, for instance, we have academic boycotters at Cornell University who tried to block a partnership that Cornell was forming with the Technion in Haifa to create a joint Institute of Applied Sciences, or faculty boycotters at Syracuse University who published an open letter in the school newspaper that censured Syracuse University department for violating the academic boycott guidelines, the PACB guidelines, by co-hosting a conference with Tel Aviv University. And at our university, the University of California, 130 faculty members signed a petition to shut down the study abroad program in Israel, which is a very popular program. And 85 faculty members from California State University campuses signed a similar petition. So we have a few examples, and we have a few more than that, but these are some examples, but they are pretty hard to find of actually faculty who are implementing the guidelines of the academic boycott. So in our current study, the one I'm speaking about now, we wanted to go beyond anecdotal evidence to actually empirically examine the question of whether academic boycotters bring their support for BDS to campus. So we looked at every department, program, or institute affiliated with the three disciplines that we knew were the biggest culprits, that is to say, ethnic, gender, and Middle East studies. So we looked at every single department, program, or institute in those three disciplines at the schools in our study. And there were 550 of these departments. And we looked at them to see whether the presence of faculty boycotters in these departments increased the likelihood that their departments, that those departments would sponsor an Israel-related public event that included speakers who had previously expressed support for BDS. So of the 324 Israel-related events that we identified as having been sponsored by one or more of these departments in either 2015 or 2016. So we looked in every single department of ethnic, gender, or Middle East studies at the 113 schools that were in our study. And we went through their databases and we looked for any event that had to do with Israel in those departments, at those schools, in those years, in that 2-year period. And we found about 324 such events. And of those 324 events, 208, or about 64% of those events, included pro-BDS speakers. And then what we did was we looked at the relationship between those departments that sponsored those pro-BDS speaker events and the number of faculty boycotters in those departments. And what we found was that departments with one or more faculty boycotters, they were 5 to 12 times more likely to sponsor public events with pro-BDS speakers. And the more faculty boycotters in a department, the more events with pro-BDS speakers. And these correlations were extraordinarily high in all three disciplines. There was really no shadow of a statistical doubt that there was this very, very strong relationship between the number of boycotters and the number of events that were sponsored by these departments that were that included pro-BDS speakers. So although we didn't have access to recordings or firsthand accounts of the majority of events that we included in the study, and so we didn't know for sure what the speakers actually said, we did have access to and review the recordings or firsthand accounts of over one-third of the events with pro-BDS speakers. And in those events that we could actually watch or listen to, we found that two-thirds of them contained anti-Zionist content, including the demonization and delegitimization of Israel. And in about a quarter to a third of the events, we identified speakers who openly promoted BDS. So taken all together, our results really strongly suggest that at least some faculty who have signed petitions or statements in support of an academic boycott of Israel actually do bring their anti-Israel sentiments and support for BDS to campus through, and this is one mechanism that we actually examine, so that's really the only mechanism that we can speak with certainty about in terms of our evidence, that they actually use their department's sponsorship of Israel-related events to include speakers who have similar anti-Israel sentiments. So moving on to the third question in our study, or the third question that our study sought to answer, was how do academic boycotters who promote BDS on campus actually contribute to campus anti-Semitism? Which is really the question that we the big question that we set out to understand. So here's what we found. We found that schools with departments that sponsored events with pro-BDS speakers were twice as likely to have acts of aggression against Jewish students. And the more speaker events, the more anti-Jewish hostility. We also found that these pro-BDS speaker events were strongly correlated with student anti-Zionist expression. Student events, but also student campus rhetoric that we actually had identified and logged into our database that were anti-Zionist. And we also found that the student anti-Zionist expression was itself associated with a sevenfold increase in acts of anti-Jewish hostility. So schools with incidents of anti-Zionist expression from students were seven times more likely to show acts of anti-Jewish hostility. So what we believe is happening here, I mean, the sense that we make out of these results is that these departmentally sponsored events, these pro-BDS speaker events, are conferring academic legitimacy on politically motivated anti-Zionist expression and activism. And this, in turn, is really encouraging students to adopt similar anti-Israel perspectives and to engage in similar anti-Zionist expression. It's not a big surprise. And that both of these things, that both faculty and student anti-Zionist expression and BDS promotion on campus, either in classrooms, conference halls, or the campus square, that these in turn contribute to a campus climate that's hostile to Jewish and pro-Israel students. We also think that many acts of anti-Jewish hostility on campus are really an inevitable consequence of the intolerant nature of an academic boycott of Israel, whose goal is not only to limit the free flow of ideas regarding Israel, but to actually and actively suppress individuals, especially Jewish students who express views or engage in actions that are sympathetic to Israel. So it's actually the very nature of the academic boycott itself that almost inevitably can't help itself but lead to acts of suppressing Jewish students in ways that are aggressive and include harassment, discrimination, occasionally even assault, and really shutting down their speech, like shutting down their events. So I want to shift gears now and talk strategically about how to address the problem of faculty who bring BDS to campus and the harms it causes. And I want to start by mentioning what Lila and I understand to be the four biggest challenges to addressing the problem, because I think you have to understand the obstacles before you can strategize about what to do to overcome those obstacles. So I'm sure when I'm speaking about these challenges that most of you are aware of these things. None of this is new to most of you, but I think it's worthwhile still to bring them up and to make this this list. So the first challenge to actually addressing the problem is academic freedom, which some faculty, of course, believe allows them to promote BDS on campus, free from scrutiny, free from criticism. Many faculty believe that promoting BDS and other quote-unquote social justice causes is actually part of their academic responsibilities. And actually, in many cases, they're supported in their belief by their academic departments. In fact, in most departments of ethnic and gender studies, in a survey that we did, and remember, a large majority of academic boycotters are affiliated with these disciplines. In most of these departments, promoting social justice is part of the departmental mission and something that's actually expected of all faculty members. For example, the College of Ethnic Studies at San Francisco State University describes as an aspect of its mission, actively implementing a vision of social justice, I'm quoting now, actively implementing a vision of social justice focusing on eliminating inequalities motivated by race and ethnicity. So faculty in these departments who promote BDS, especially if they're in these disciplines, are more likely to actually be applauded by their colleagues and even their department chairs than condemned for promoting BDS at the university, in their classrooms, and at the conference hall. A second related challenge is that there are whole disciplines that have become, and again, this is not new for most of you, but that there are whole disciplines that have become the mouthpiece for the ideological underpinnings of BDS, which include lies and defamations about Israel, like Israel is an illegitimate settler, colonial, apartheid, racist state that engages in heinous crimes against humanity, including ethnic cleansing, murder, rape, and the theft of Palestinian land, and of course, bodily organs. So whole fields of study, in fact, have embraced these ideas and given them academic legitimacy, making it that much easier to make the case, that the BDS case, that Israel must be isolated from the family of nations through economic, academic, and cultural boycotts, and ultimately, of course, destroyed. So that's the second point, which is that this ideology and this rhetoric is so deeply rooted and has become normalized in these departments and disciplines that it really becomes difficult to address. The third challenge to taking on the on-campus BDS promotion by faculty boycotters is I would call it the principle of shared governance, which puts the responsibility for what happens in the classroom and conference hall squarely in the hands of faculty. So it's faculty and not administrators who have to ensure that academic freedom is not abused by faculty boycotters. But what happens when the faculty who are charged with providing oversight of a department's academic programming, like the department chairs or program directors, what happens when these oversight sort of administrators or administrators faculty are themselves supporters of the academic boycott of Israel? Now, I didn't mention this before, but in our study, we found that over 200 departments, programs, and institutes at the schools in our study, over 200 of them were headed by academic boycotters. So this is a real challenge. It's the challenge of oversight. Who's gonna make an issue of these things if the very people who are charged with making an issue, if there's a problem, are themselves part of the problem? So the fourth and final challenge is really the frustrating reality that neither faculty nor administrators have been willing to enforce university policy or the law that would prohibit the on-campus promotion or implementation of BDS by faculty. So I want to conclude with a few recommendations for addressing the problem of faculty who bring their support for the academic boycott of Israel to campus. And these aren't meant to be exhaustive, but really they're food for thought, for discussion, and hopefully we can have that discussion in the last part of this call. So the first recommendation is addressed to faculty, and that's that, you know, given that it's faculty who are primarily responsible for determining and approving the content of all academic programming and for evaluating whether faculty behavior is protected by academic freedom or not, we urge academic senate members to begin a conversation with their peers about the appropriateness of things like departmentally sponsored events that include the promotion of an academic boycott of Israel, the appropriateness of faculty who advocate for an academic boycott of Israel in their classrooms or course curricula or on their university website, and the appropriateness of faculty who implement the academic boycotts guidelines, including by boycotting the school's study abroad programs in Israel or refusing to write letters of recommendations for students wishing to study in Israel or attempting to undermine their colleagues' research collaborations with Israeli scholars or institutions. I think it's faculty themselves who have to bring up with their fellow faculty that these things you know, maybe more or less, but I think certainly the last one about implementing an academic boycott of Israel and actually hurting your own colleagues and students is an absolute outrage that should get faculty talking to each other and saying, no, this is not acceptable. So the second recommendation is addressed to administrators who we think need to be vigilant about the ways in which official guidelines of the academic boycott of Israel, if carried out, would actually restrict the academic freedom of their faculty and students, and we believe actually violate university policy and the law. The administrators should pay special attention to faculty boycotters who were chairs or directors of academic units and therefore serve in administrative capacity and have extra responsibilities and obligations. And university leaders should publicly commit, we believe, to ensuring that no faculty or student will be impeded from engaging with Israeli scholars or institutions, academic institutions, because of an academic boycott of Israel. Those are the things that we think are within the purview and actually we can demand or recommend, urge administrators to do. And finally, the third set of recommendations has to do with government officials, specifically government officials at the Department of Education, who oversee the federal funding of Middle East studies programs. We believe that they really have to be made aware of and concerned about the extent to which faculty and directors of federally funded Middle East studies programs inject their support for an academic boycott of Israel into their academic programming engage in implementing an academic boycott on their campuses, which is really, when you look at it, it's absolutely in direct violation of the stipulations and the intent of their federal funding. So we believe that we can essentially urge, demand that DOE officials should either ensure that federally funded programs comply with the letter and spirit of the law, or they should defund them. So those are the recommendations. That's a bit about our study. Leila, did you want to jump in?
I think you laid the data on the table, and I think questions are very welcome at this point. Questions, comments.
Wonderful. Well, thank you both for thank you, Tammy, for the very comprehensive layout of the problem. So the floor is now open. As I mentioned before, if you have a question, please hit the icon of the hand, and I will unmute you, and you can ask your question. I guess as people are feeling the floor, let me take the prerogative as the moderator and ask the first question. So with everything, we had no disagreement with all your findings, unfortunately, that we were seeing around. Are we seeing, and as the study revealed, clear curricula implementation, as well as, sources and other kinds of documents that, these faculty, these scholar activists who support BDS are bringing in? Are we seeing that kind of data being brought in and correlated with their own, obviously Middle East studies, but also with other associations, that kind of attempt to, by those same individuals, to push boycott with the associations and within their and within their individual classrooms. Is that clearly in the findings?
So are you, go ahead, Lila.
No, so perhaps if I address that. That's the big elephant in the room. What happens in classrooms is very much hidden. Students, for example, in many states, including California, though they do record, those recordings cannot be made public unless the teacher assents to it.
Right.
And otherwise, it's a federal crime or a state crime. So, it's very difficult. And students, of course, some students, of course, will report what's happened in their classroom. But many students, they don't want to have trouble. They don't want to have conflict with their professors. So they don't report. So that clearly is an area that needs research, needs examination, needs empirical study. We would like to move into that arena. We have to do it very slowly and very carefully and very cautiously.
Right. So I'm in particular thinking, you know, just to kind of piggyback on your response into this whole current ongoing case with Jasbar Puar, who obviously was one of the proponents behind the ASA boycott, leading up to the publication of her latest book, or whatever you want to call it, exactly, or her findings, which I would define as academic garbage. There was a lot of flack that she got about, you know, or she demanded that none of her public lectures could be recorded. In everything that you guys have done, is that a violation as a public speech? That was that allowed for her to do, putting aside the classroom format, but was she allowed to demand that the public lectures also not be recorded?
Tammy, do you have an opinion?
I can give my belief, which is either right or wrong, because I think that there actually is a legal, I think there's a legal threshold for what can happen. I would think that she can. I would think that it's okay. I mean, I think it's okay if a faculty member doesn't want their appearances to be recorded. I mean, we do. When I've spoken, I have had to sign waivers that say it's okay to record this talk. I could decline, and there are times when I do decline, and I don't want to be recorded. So, I mean, I actually, it's hard to say this, but I actually feel for her, because I think that she's, you know, I think a faculty, I think someone has the right to not want other people going through and looking for things to, you know, to use against them. And I think that we actually have to be a little careful about what we do. We try to be very careful in our research to not overstep our bounds and to not look like or even give the appearance of, you know, doing something that violates the academic freedom or the free speech rights of, you know, a faculty, even though we think there's a real problem. I mean, so Jasbir Puar is an interesting case from my perspective, which is that she writes specifically in her new book, The Right to Maine, but also in the essay, the long essay that it was based on, she writes specifically that she's operating out of what she calls an anti-Zionist hermeneutic, that her work is actually part of this anti-Zionist hermeneutic, and that it's being used in the service of supporting the Palestinian cause. She writes that explicitly. And to me, that's a perfect example of exactly what I talked about, you know, as being one of the biggest challenges for us, is that these notions have the notion that you can actually operate in a political framework that your research is done for in the service of a political cause, in this case the service of trying to destroy Israel, essentially, that's actually accepted. I mean, she wrote it in a very naive, unabashed way, thinking that this is perfectly acceptable. And the thing is, in her field, which is, women and gender studies, it actually is perfectly acceptable. It actually is, to her credit. She actually does get, tenure and published in whatever press, Duke University Press, I'm not sure, but some, well-known press. So, I mean, that's the real problem. I mean, we can cringe and we can say it's horrible, but the fact is that it has been legitimized, that it is taken to be, authoritative, and it is taken to be scholarly, and it is taken to be the basis for the field. Her findings are just, the truth from which everything else is built up after that. And that's what we do. So, I mean, I know you wanted to talk about the recording issue, but I think this is a more important, the bigger issue here is the way in which these faculty are actually completely corrupting their disciplines, and there's very little that we can do about it, except if we think strategically and involve faculty in this.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, I think, the recording is a symptom. I mean, I think, of the larger problem. And I think that you are absolutely correct with that. Clearly, there is a kind of, this is her, her ability to articulate these perspectives under the prism in which she's working on is one thing. And obviously, the tension between one's opinions and one's scholarship or politics that are being taken over within a classroom setting in a field like women's studies and whatnot is obviously quite telling about the kind of balance that those students are receiving on the other side. Are there even other sides even being discussed when this is the prevailing raison d'etre of the field at large?
Right.
I mean, I think that those are the big questions. I mean, obviously, no disagreement on the findings and the issues we're facing. The floor is open. I encourage people to ask questions. Now is the time to do so. As I said before, if you have a question, please click on the hand icon and I will be able to unmute you and you'll be able to ask your question. So, do so. Leela, do you want to add any more in the meantime as we're waiting for people or encouraging people to ask
sure.
a question?
No, I just want to underscore what Tammy said, which is that, we're fighting BDS, we're fighting, the attack on Israel, but what undergirds and makes the fight so difficult is what, to my mind, as an old-fashioned academic, is the ongoing corruption of the university mission itself. And, I grew up and went to university and taught at university in which the professor was to be objective and scholarship was, was to pursue the truth, not to pursue an end, not to pursue a political ideology, not to pursue social justice, but to find the truth. And that dictum is condemned by many faculty now, simply dismissed. So I think it's important that we recognize that there's an ongoing issue with universities themselves as well as, BDS.
Agreed.
I think one of the,
go ahead.
I was going to say, I think one of the things, I mean, we're talking what the things that upset us and the things that are sort of the lay of the land, but I think if we think strategically, about what we can and should latch on to be able to, you know, I think, I don't know, find the Achilles heel or how we can make a difference given the enormity of the problem, really, because as Leela said, it is the corruption goes to the heart of the academy. And in some ways, it's been going on for about 30 or 40 years. I think it's reached it's only getting worse. So it's at the lowest point in 30 or 40 years. So I think it's this Herculean task. But I think that there are things that we can latch on to. And one of those things, I think that the things that we can latch on to are the places where this advocacy. I was bringing this up in terms of the difference between the two kinds of anecdotes that we have about the boycott, the academic boycott, and it's bringing the academic boycott to campus. Because on the one hand, you have people who promote the academic boycott, who advocate for it, who say, well, I support it, and I think you should support it too, essentially. That's the promotion of it. But it's a whole other thing altogether when that faculty member decides that they're going to be a warrior and actually carry out the guidelines of the petition that they signed. So that everybody who signs the ACBI or US ACBI academic boycott petition or a statement or anything like that, you know, who say they support the academic boycott, they, you know, most people, I'm not sure that they actually have read carefully the guidelines, but that's what they're supposed to do. It's, you know, you don't just sign, you don't just pay lip service to this, you're actually supposed to engage. I mean, why sign it if you're not going to carry out the guidelines? So, but the point is, if they carry out those guidelines, there really is direct, substantive, and even measurable harm that comes not to Israel and Israeli universities and scholars, but actually to U.S. students and faculty. And that's got to be absolutely unacceptable to everybody. That once that point is raised, that there are real harms that you can actually see and measure. And, you know, I'm sure, you know, let's say an SPME, how many SPME faculty have, you know, collaborations with scholars, you know, Israeli scholars or research in or teach at or just even visit Israeli universities or want to host Israeli speakers or even Israeli leaders for their classes or want to send their students to education abroad programs. I bet a large percentage of SPME affiliated faculty are in that situation. They themselves are the direct victims. They would be the direct victims of an academic boycott of Israel. And that's got to be absolutely outrageous and unacceptable. So I think if we start from that point where there is measurable harm, as opposed to it being a war of ideas, as opposed to having to looking like we're trying to take away the academic freedom of a faculty member to be able to express their opinion, or even to build their research around an anti-Zionist hermeneutic like Jasbir Puar. I mean, if we try to say that's not acceptable, then that looks like we are McCarthyites and violating their academic freedom. But if we actually look at the harms that they cause, and if we can show that they're actually taking away the academic freedom and the freedom of speech and the educational opportunities of their students and colleagues, then I think that we're in a great position to make the case to university administrators, certainly to the public, that there is a problem here. And I think that's an important thing that we should think about and strategize on further, Asaf. You know, the ways in which to focus on the harm that is measurable, which is what we try to do. We try to measure the harm. And, you know, whether it's anecdotal or empirical, I think that we can make the case that the academic boycott in action, in effect, is absolutely unacceptable, and is even, I think, morally depraved in a way that you do something that puts your own students, your own colleagues in harm's way has got to be seen as being the lowest of the low. And I think that's the case that we have to make if we want to actually raise these issues and make a difference on the campus.
Agreed. I mean, do you see that, you know, tying into some of these lawsuits? I mean, you know, are there enough actionable items, you know, apropos Leela's comment about what the role of the university is? And now you're seeing, you know, again, going back to the ASA, where you do have this ongoing lawsuit of members or former members who are now taking on the association for its corruptness or for the fact that it doesn't stand for what it used to be, as a result of these scholar activists who basically hijacked the entire discipline by putting out this information. I mean, are you foreseeing more actionable legal items as a result of the findings of this and what the basic tenets of the university should be, and that we have clear violations of those really basic codes of conduct?
Leela, did you want to answer that?
Well, I think our exposure of these issues and SPME's exposure and make it more feasible for legal cases to go forward. You know, when there is more sort of, you know, public agreement, legislative agreement as to what is wrong. But we're just at the beginning of it.
Right. I mean,
right. And I think it's the same process, I think, that the lawsuit, I mean, what the lawsuit focuses on is damage, right? What you have to have damages to be able to bring a lawsuit. If there are no damages, you don't have a lawsuit.
Right.
So I think that's what we're saying, but not in a legal, not in an official legal way, this isn't a lawsuit, but this is just making the case. This is a strategic observation or, you know, a strategic idea, which is that to take the damage and to use that as a way of being able to both raise the issue and force people who are in charge and whose job it is to be, you know, to do something about problems like damages to do those things. Right. So we just want faculty and administrators to just do their jobs. I mean, everybody has a job that they have to do by their contracts. And what we're finding is, you know, that was one of our challenges, is that people aren't doing their jobs. They're not following their contracts. They're not following the laws and the policies of the university. And so what we're trying to do is to bring such a case that they can actually see that they really do need to follow. There really are laws. There really are policies. I mean, for instance, at the University of California, and I wanted to say this as well, strategically, there is a policy, which I actually haven't found such a policy on other university campuses, but at the University of California, there is a policy that was put out by the regents in 1970 and reaffirmed more recently, that says that the use of the university classroom for the purposes of political indoctrination is a misuse of the classroom, right? And so when you have the regents in a policy that's quite clear, you can't use the classroom, a UC classroom, for political indoctrination, you can actually hold that up and say, look, you know, the regents have a policy. Look what's happening in this classroom. This is a clear violation of the UC Regents policy on course content, which is what it's called. And you, the chancellor of this university, are obliged to do something about it. So then the question, I mean, then you can begin to argue, is this political indoctrination or not? But at least you're having the conversation, right? At least you have something around which to build that conversation. Whereas if you didn't have a policy like that, you would be out of luck. You couldn't even have the conversation.
Well, I mean, I think so go ahead.
No, that's it. I just think that we should actually look for policies like that and look for laws, state laws, even federal laws, that will help us to make the case that there's something amiss, that there's real harm here, that there's really a violation of policy and the law. And then we need to hit home with that with university administrators and maybe even state and federal legislators or officials if the administrators still fail to do their jobs.
And do you believe that those kind of points can be incorporated in the BDS legislations that are out there now currently? I mean, now there are about 24 states that have legislated anti-BDS laws. Is this something that you think will be, you know, feasible to incorporate some of these points that you're raising today in order to hold the university accountable within those states?
Well, right now, the anti-BDS legislations that are extant are not, they're not about the campus at all, and they're about commerce, and
right.
It doesn't, it's the economic, it's not, it, these I see these as unrelated, and I don't see that there is a way to connect them, and I think it would be unwise to do that, because it would raise the blowback would be tremendous, and I just actually don't think that these anti-BDS bills are relevant at all to what it is that we're doing.
Okay, so that's so they're two separate issues, and really, you know, can't be incorporated, even though, you know, in some regard they're raising, you know, public awareness or consciousness of the illegality of a boycott itself. But they don't hold any water when it comes to academia, you know, with regard to versus the financial and economic angle that they're taking.
Correct.
Even when it comes to Title VI issues, as far as, you know, coming together when it comes to, like, you know, the, you know, federal funding. I mean, even on those specific programs, you don't think we can make a dent there as well and try to expand the net? That's not something you see as useful in that regard.
No, the opposite. About when you're talking about federal funding, I mean, I think that we should and could, but it would be different from these anti-BDS bills that you're talking about. I think,
right,
especially like what I talked about at the end there, in terms of the final recommendation, I should say, in terms of going to the Department of Education, this the Title VI of the Higher Education Act that funds area studies. And, you know, since 1965, and one of the main areas of funding is the Middle East studies. And yes, there are, you know, we've done some studies about the schools that receive funding from the federal government, Middle East studies schools, and, you know, the extent to which the boycotters have really are really a major force in those departments, and are chaired. You know, that we found that, for instance, of the 16 federally funded Middle East studies programs under this grant called the Grant Pro Federal Grant Program, Title VI of the Higher Education Act, there are 16 Middle East studies programs that receive altogether $20 million over a few year period, which is a lot of money. Right, that a quarter of them are chaired by academic boycotters, and many more, and many of the faculty members, and some of those programs are actually dominated by faculty boycotters. So this is a real problem, and to show the way in which, I mean, one of the basic purposes of the federal funding in these areas is to actually increase and expand the research collaborations and study programs in that country. Because how do you study a country, which is what the government is tasking you to do for national security purposes, to help increase the, you know, the information, the knowledge, and the expertise, you know, to train students to be able to go into, you know, government service and to help in those particular areas? How can you actually do your job for which you're getting millions of dollars of federal funds if you're actually working to shutting down the very programs that you're supposed to be expanding? So it's such a clear violation of the intent of the funding that if we can raise that issue to the federal officials, the Department of Education, even the legislators, I think that this is critically, this could be a game changer for, you know, for this, for at least with respect to this these Middle East studies programs. It could be a real game changer.
No, I don't disagree. I mean, I think that you're right about that. I mean, I think that today, unfortunately, we seem to have a quiet crew on the phone and on the computer. So, I mean, again, if there are any questions, please raise your hand. We are coming to the end, you know, and obviously, you know, I want to, you know, if people don't feel comfortable asking questions now, they could always email us again at bdsmonitor@spme.org. I mean, obviously, you know, the there's a great deal of work. And again, I want to thank both Leela and Tammy for all the work that you have done. SPME and AMCHA have collaborated over the years and will continue to do so. And I think that this research that you have done is extremely valuable and something that, you know, we should be using, as both of you have mentioned, as we look to tackle the many problems that we're facing. In the last few minutes that we have, some final words from either of you, the floor is yours. And obviously we will be getting all of this information out to our membership and of today's call, and we will continue the conversation. So Tammy, Leela, any more final words about any of this stuff?
Well, this is Leela. So I just want to say that, you know, there are at least two aspects to the harm that BDS does to American citizens as well as Israeli citizens. And one is the economic that you, Asaf, raised in terms of the anti-BDS legislation in many states. That has to do with the economic effect of boycotts. And I think it is in some way what Israel itself, you know, was concerned about. But the other impact is ideological. It is what we are teaching our students, our children, who will then become leaders. And so when people review the effects of BDS on campus, you know, not many of them, you know, some of them have been passed, some of them have been defeated. But in the struggle, you know, to make the resolutions, you know, the ideology is being tainted on campus and students are absorbing that.
No doubt. I mean, I think that this is, a major issue that we are facing going forward, and obviously for the well-being of academia and the well-being of our students and at large about the kind of information that they are being taught, they deserve better. I mean, I think that that's, you know, why all of us do what we do. And I think that this is part of what AMCHA and SPME together and respectively, you know, have been concerned about for many years, which is why we're trying to raise a lot of these issues so everybody can be aware of what they can and can't do. So obviously, very important work, and I think that the study is very valuable and will be very helpful as many of us and many of try to frame the problem and what we can do to tackle it. So really, I personally want to thank you. I think that it's wonderful and it's very useful. And I thank everybody who was on the call today. I think that say that the silence is a sign of agreement or questions that, you know, a lot of food for thought that will come later on. And so, again, this is something that we will continue the conversation as we progress. But I want to thank again both Tammy and Leela for all your hard work. And I want to thank everybody on the call today for joining us. And we will definitely continue the conversation on our next BDS call. And have a great afternoon. And thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, Asaf. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.